All right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson, and tonight we're doing another one of our live book club events. We're recording this on April 10th, 2011 at 8 p.m. Mountain Time. If you want to hear any of our live recordings, you can head out to ustream.tv and do a search for a Mormon Expression, and there you can find a schedule of our upcoming live broadcasts. One note of change, we do have our feedback episode listed for next week on April 17th. That has been moved to May 1st, I believe. But if you check the schedule, you'll be able to see. All right. So what else do we need to announce?
Sign up for the cruise.
Oh, yes. The cruise on January 27th of 2012. If you go to the website and follow the link, you can get a link to our travel agent who will help you get everything squared away. We look forward to seeing you there with Zilpha and I. And, of course, the live event on August 6th. I believe we are now settled on a location. Robin's giving me a frowny face because she doesn't like my location, but it will be at the Avalon in Salt Lake City, which is 3600 South on State Street. We will have a way to purchase tickets here up on the board in a little bit. If you want to reserve your tickets early, you can send me an email at john@mormonexpression.com. I'll get you on the list. Tickets will be $17 advance and $22 at the door. Right. You're looking at me funny.
Yeah, I guess I didn't know we settled on that yet, but
I had a vision in a dream last night, so it's all settled.
There better be punch and cookies.
I don't know that food or drink is allowed at said
theater. We have
theater,
to find that out.
There is no alcohol, and it's probably PG-13. I'm guessing.
It's an all-ages venue. That's one plus.
Zilpha's got a potty mouth, so.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so tonight it's the three of us bringing it in. First of all, we have Zilpha. Hey, Zilpha.
Hello, everybody.
Zilpha, did you read the book?
I sure did.
You read it more than once.
Actually, no. Maybe like once in a quarter.
And then we have Robin. Hey, Robin, welcome back.
Happy to be here, John.
And you read the book, too?
I did also.
All right. I also did read the book this time. So
it helps.
We should all be ready to go with this masterwork. All right. So when I was trying to set up the book club, I was trying to pick a wide range of books that dealt with Mormonism. And this is probably the oldest and maybe, dare I say, the best known piece of Mormon fiction. And probably the best-known piece of Mormon fiction that you've never heard of, most people are thinking of. This book was written by Nephi Anderson. Nephi was born in 1865 and wrote this book in 1898. And it went through five printings, and then he updated it in 1912. Now, I did not myself see a pre-1912 edition. Did either of you?
No.
Nope.
And this book has been in continuous printing from 1898 until today, where you can still buy a copy of it. And so it has flooded the earth literally with this, well, not literally, but
figuratively.
There's a lot of copies of this book floating around. And, you know, if you go down to the DI, you'll find one there about every other time you look. So they are out there. And I think, Zilpha, you had a link you posted a little while ago to free version.
Yeah, there's a few of them online, literary, yes. PDF files and stuff like that. That's just on the internet for free. So,
first of all, this book is really important doctrinally because it sits in a transitional period. Now, if you remember your history, of course, we had like the Edmunds-Tucker Act, which was sort of around the time that good old Nephi was born. So his whole early life, he was lived in the era of the Mormon underground. And then by the time he published the book, you know, the manifesto had come out in 1890 that, polygamy was halted in the temples. And we were really in a transitional period between that church and the modern church. And you'll recall that in the first decade of the 20th century is when they brought in the theologian, my mind just went blank, Talmage, to sort of reconstruct Mormon doctrine and Mormon teachings to sort of get rid of all the old-timey beliefs. So we'll come to that a little bit more because I think that was really interesting because there were ideas that I didn't realize were as early as 1898 that were as solid as he gave them. So what we really get is a sort of a view into that important time in the church when we're in a transformation from that earliest phase to what we now know as modern Mormonism. So the book is important that way. And the second thing that's important, we'll get into this in detail, is it unashamedly talks about the doctrines that are uniquely Mormon. And
gives them a personal face.
Yeah, yeah. So we've mentioned this book twice before in the podcast, I believe. And I think the first time we mentioned it was when we were talking about Saturday's Warrior.
It's like the first Saturday's Warrior.
Yeah, yeah. The ideas that came up in Saturday's Warrior of the pre-existence and this love and romance that spans these, pre-life and
the
life.
The estates.
And the death and all the estates. Yeah. They didn't originate with Lex Alzevedo.
Right, but this is probably added upon, is probably the first time that someone took a fictional approach to those doctrines.
The first one that I know of, I assume there was fiction floating around.
I don't know.
Before. Well, wouldn't they all have to be somewhat fictional since we wouldn't exactly have firsthand accounts about the pre-existence that I'm aware of?
Right.
Yeah, but I think, by that we mean that the portrayal of this, doctrinal narrative in a story form, and which even today, Mormon the arts in general is not real developed. When you take, and this is something I've said before, but when you take the number of Mormons there are in the United States and compare them to other groups that have similar numbers, they'll have, a mature, literature venue. They'll have film festivals. They'll have all sorts of things. And Mormonism, when we get into the arts, tends to balloon and then collapse on itself in spans of 10 or 20 years.
Hmm. Typically, what makes art great is that it pushes the envelope, what's acceptable. It shakes up the world. It shows you something in a new way. And you can't do that and stay faith-promoting and, with the status quo. You're not going to shake people up that way, which is why, for me, for the most part, writing and art in the LDS world really is pretty kitschy.
You can go to Notre Dame, which is a Catholic-run school, and you can find people publishing books that challenge all sorts of... Like, how many people would read a book like The Chosen and say, oh, this is challenging Judaism, this is challenging Orthodoxy?
Oh, right. Actually, Chaim Potok is a wonderful writer, and I've heard him speak in person. And so, and of course, Judaism, it has a strong history from what I've heard from some of my friends that practice in Reform Judaism, that... I mean, they have a strong doubt tradition. It having the doubt and asking the questions and struggling is respected part of Judaism. It is not so much in Mormonism. For instance, when we're talking about Levi Peterson, where he said, you should be able to talk about sex, body functions, all that is part of life and is what makes great fiction great. Whereas it seems like a lot of that... isn't considered, polite or okay to include.
But even short of that,
it's not at all.
Even short of sex and violence and stuff, there's this bubble that they wrap around literature. And by the way, this book really doesn't challenge anything.
No, not at all.
Do we need
to explain the title?
It's a scriptural reference.
Right. They who keep their first estate shall be added upon. So that's where added upon came from.
Right. So let's go into the kind of the general story arc. The book starts in the pre-existence and then comes to this world and then goes to the spirit world and then ends the section four is during the millennium.
which is the strangest chapter to me.
Yes, definitely.
It was the most fascinating
chapter.
It was
definitely.
To me,
but... I've got way more markers in that chapter.
So the pre-existence, then the mortal world, and then...
The post...
Yes, the millennium.
And
we don't even make it to the... The biggie. It ends just
yeah,
before.
Yeah, never get to the celestial.
The earth is cleansed the earth is burnt to stubble. And
what happens after that? I mean, it's kind of like the end, you know?
No.
They live happily ever after.
Well, but it might be fun to explore that through fiction, too.
Yeah, but how interesting would that be?
I don't know.
Actually, they made the millennium kind of interesting, but maybe we don't want to talk about that yet.
Yeah.
Save the exciting stuff for the end.
So the story... involves, and I have to say, you know, this was written 110 years ago or whatever. It's not particularly well written.
Not at all.
The characters are not really strongly developed, and everybody is sort of melodramatic. You know, the good guys are all really good. He doesn't really have a lot of bad guys, but they're just sort of cardboard cutouts.
I thought there was some depth to the characters, and apparently when he originally wrote it, it was... even a lot less detailed about the characters, and he added details for his second or third printing. Anyway, he
added a lot for the fifth.
For
I
the
believe.
Fifth. Mm-hmm. So originally he was just kind of doing more of a very general story, and he added more details because people wanted more. People wanted to have more information about the characters and their families and stuff. But I didn't think it was so kind of black and white characters. I thought they were
besides
kind of
Lucifer.
Yeah, I thought they were kind of more round. There were good things and bad things about most of the characters, I thought.
Yes, and I remember I can't cite a page where some of the discussion is it isn't so much that people are evil, but you know, weak, mm-hmm. you know, lazy, mm-hmm. that kind of a thing. So that seems to be a nicer view.
Yeah,
of sin.
One of the individuals out in the chat room says that they had a hard time figuring out who was who.
I did
when they
too.
Had different names.
And, oh, no kidding!
That's part of my point is in the pre-existence they have their pre-existence names.
Yeah, which was for the main couple was Delsa and Homan.
Yes, and then you don't learn until like the seventh to the last page. Who those were, but there's not enough clues like given.
There's no clues.
There's no character from the.
And there's more than one couple going on in the earth, you know, in the earth life. So you're like, okay, so who is Delsa and Homan? Which
right.
couple is
and
this?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
On second reading, it makes a little more sense, at least as far as the Volmer character who had been Sargon?
Sardis,
excuse me. Because, of course, they did a lot of talk about the music. But when you're getting all the pre-existent stuff, that was the very most awful, worst part of the book. You know, it used the ye will, this and that. it was hard to make it through.
Yeah, they spoke in.
Well, see, and I think that's why I was so clueless through the first, probably through my first reading, frankly, because that first chapter gives you so much information. And when it's written so horribly, although it got much better. I think once it came to Earth life, the writing was much better. It was a tad more active, not quite as passive as the first chapter. And I'm not sure why godly speech is passive tense, because it's horrible, it's boring, and who likes to listen to that?
Now, let's before we eviscerate it too much, it is much better than the scriptures. Now, I'd rather read Nephi Anderson than Joseph Smith any day.
Oh, definitely. I agree.
So he does. It is much better than the Pearl Great Price. So if you're having trouble understanding the Pearl Great Price, hey, get yourself a copy of Added Upon.
So they basically start out with the war in heaven and Lucifer leading people one way and others following the Savior. And of course, Delsa and Homan follow Jesus and the Volmer character,
Sardis,
who Robin mentioned, he's a musician, and he originally follows Lucifer and then changes his mind, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. He then changes his mind, and they're surprised when they see him after the little war in heaven is over, and he's with them. Yay!
Yep. So, and that's pretty much all that happens in the pre-existence, except for Delsa and Homan kind of fall in love. And they speculate about the earth life a little bit, but not in like any real terms. It's all more scriptural language, you know?
And wasn't it beautiful, the description? And I guess this is part of the thing that hearkens, or Saturday's Warrior hearkens to it. where it was talking about Delsa sitting and she was looking at all the men in the throng and taking each little piece of them and, oh, that's not quite right. That's not quite right. And then she assembles all the best and all of a sudden there we've got Homan and he is the picture
that she was looking for.
Yes. That connection.
Yes.
Did you guys catch the paragraph about the blacks?
I did at the end.
There's one on page 18. Then there were others, not valiant in either cause, who stood on neutral ground. Without strength of character to come out boldly, they aided neither the right nor the wrong. Weak-minded as they were, they could not be trusted, nor could Lucifer win them over.
Oh, man.
Oh.
So there's an early
reference. Of course, he doesn't say that they would be the black ones, but as Mormons, we know the doctrine.
That would be the equivalent of saying, nowhere does it say that sunbeams are 3-year-olds. Everybody knows that. You don't have to say it. I mean, it's an ever-present doctrine. It just
shows
up everywhere.
I think that falls into assumption, John.
But it is assumable in this context in the late 1800s.
He didn't have to say over and over and over again.
So is it just black, or do you think there's anyone else that would be included in that group?
Well, for Mormons, it's just black. What about the Lamanites?
Well, for 19th century Mormons, they used it to excuse just about everybody else outside the European world. So they weren't necessarily denied the priesthood, but they were all sort of others, the less valid, because you have to explain, okay, well, if this is the true church, then why are there 1 billion people in India and 1 billion people in China who, have never heard of it? And apparently God has never made any effort to
contact
them. So you have to have some explanation even back to the 19th century. What did Brigham Young say? Zilf, we were reading that a year or so ago, he said in the afterlife, the Chinaman would wash the dishes, basically. Yeah. So, if you're even a little sensitive, you have to explain why the rest of the world's not involved. There was the doctrine of they're all descended from Ham or whatever, and there you go. So why would somebody from their first estate, who apparently vanquished Satan, come down to be in a position where they couldn't get the gospel? You have to have some sort of explanation. To me, it's not an unreasonable assumption. And I think it's still probably implied in the doctrine today, although they wouldn't. Matter of fact, I was even talking to somebody at BYU back when I was a student, and they said, well, yeah, that was true then. The blacks before 1978 were unvaliant, but that's not true now. But there are people who are unvaliant. They're just born into different avenues where they don't receive the gospel. So, it's not a dead doctrine.
He does have an interesting view of this pre-Earth life. It's more developed than like the Saturday's Warrior version, where there's trees and it's not just clouds and people walking around. He says the vastness of the spiritual world held enough for study, research, and for occupation. So he kind of saw it as the pre-Earth life, like an Earth-like existence. But just not mortal.
Yeah. Then afterwards, in the spirit world, one of the individuals is tending to his rose bushes.
Yes.
Yes.
And
they had actual houses.
Well, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to mention as part of that, the idea that animals and plant life and everything existed in a spirit form as well as a mortal earthly form.
Right. Nobody was slapping mosquitoes in the pre-existence, at least not in this story.
Well,
but
they were perfected. They were kind.
And I thought he did a reasonable good job of explaining, as the characters are interacting in the pre-existence, there's male and femaleness, but there's no like sexual attraction between the two. There's no sense of attraction in that first thing.
Well, there is a little.
Well, he implies that he likes being around this person. But, they specifically state that they don't have the desires and those sort of things they'll get in the mortal.
Yeah. Homan had often, thoughts had often been with the fair sister, Delsa. Then he says, but why should it be so?
Exactly.
He didn't know. Delsa was fair, but so were all the daughters of God. She had attained to great intelligence, so had thousands of others. So wherein lay the secret of the power which drew him to her?
Right, right.
So he was drawn to her, even though maybe he didn't have an idea of what, sexual attraction was.
This is what I really loved about the book, is where you have these abstract sort of doctrinal ideas, like, okay, you have free agency in the pre-Earth life, but what does that mean? And then you didn't have a body, so you didn't have physical desire. So how would that play out? And how would that be different than this world? So, you know, he sort of toyed around with that idea a little bit, which was sort of interesting.
Yep. And so then they kind of get their appointments to go to Earth Life. And then the part two starts with no explanation. So as soon as they leave the pre-existence, then...
Then Earth Life begins.
Are you not done with the pre-existence?
No, I'm done with the pre-existence.
Oh, okay.
I think Nephi was trying to do that to, like, as an implication of the veil.
Right. Yes. It's a complete mystery who you were before you got here.
Right.
And so we don't know who they are.
Yeah, I think that was intentional, that, you know, he wanted them to, the reader, to, you know, feel that same sort of disjointedness.
I think that was, you know, fairly good device. It was sort of a mystery as I was trying to figure out, so who is Delsa and who is Homan? Because it wasn't at all clear.
Right, right. And I think that was intentional. If I were writing the book, and since I'm a world-renowned author, I would have, you know, if I was writing the book, I'd probably rely on lazy sort of storytelling things we do now, like flashbacks. So maybe his would be better than mine. But I would try to, like, throw hints about the characters.
That's what I would do.
And how exactly, you know, because he did imply that they were sort of, you know, there were noble spirits. And he has a scene in the beginning where they check, you know, they're trying to find people to do a certain role, you know, so they can help bring others back. And so he implies that, you know, it's not just random chance who you're born with. There's character there.
I think Sardis was pretty clear, though. I really enjoyed, you could tell who he was just because they talked about him, you know, that worried him because he was spending so much time with music, and you need to be well-rounded and mediocre at everything.
What you were just saying, I guess I wasn't done with the pre-Earth life. I remembered where I... read that other part about the blacks, or that made me think of the blacks, is that a messenger approached a group of people and said that they were looking for someone to go to be kinsmen with a certain family of earth children who had fallen into evil ways. He said, not being very strong for the truth before they left us, their experiences in the other world have not made them stronger. This family, it seems, has become rooted in false doctrine and wrong living, so that those who come to them from us partake also of their error and unbelief of the truth. So they wanted some really stalwart people to go join their family.
We learned who that was. Who that was in the last chapter.
What?
It was the woman who never got married till the afterlife. Remember, because the veil parts and they see that they remember that.
So it was Rachel.
Yeah, I believe so. I'd have to go pull that. I didn't mark that one.
Really?
Yeah. Because she was shunned by her family. Remember when her cousin... Anyway, we're getting into dirty details.
Yeah.
So the book centers around a couple of different couples. And it goes from the West. It actually starts in an undescript Rocky Mountain town that's not a Mormon settlement, but sure sounds like one. Mm-hmm. They're burning sagebrush and they have like dugouts and stuff like that.
And they've got ravines and mountains and...
And then they go back and forth between this place and Norway.
Yep. Yes.
It's your standard sort of Mormon tale of people joining the church and then finding their relatives and running into other people who join the church. Sort of the same thing you see in The Work and the Glory, that sort of character intertwining.
And there was a huge focus throughout the book on the temple work and the importance of genealogy and getting the work done for your dead ancestors.
Right, yeah.
And a lot of that makes a lot of sense according to Nephi's, you know, background. Of course, he was born in Norway. They emigrated. He did work. What was his genealogy work? Anyway, part of his time was spent with genealogy work, and that was a big...
It was important to him.
Yes.
Yeah, and when he was a young man, a very young man, there wouldn't have been any temples. At the time.
At the time this book was written, there were four.
Yeah, there were four.
Says four in here.
Yeah, that's the number.
Okay, so it would have been difficult to get to the temple. And he even plays out some of that characteristics. Like, he has characters that go to the temple and then don't get back for 10 or 15 years, which would have been common at the time. I was reading a little while ago that there was a member of the 70 in the 19th century, and he was in the 70, and it turned out he'd only been to the temple once when he got his own endowment. So that wasn't that odd. They were hard to get to, and if you didn't live around them, you know, you didn't get to them at all. Yeah, but his one of the big things in the work is about that temple work, because it has relationships in front of and behind the veil. But there is a sort of a weird thing that happens in the afterlife.
Let's just kind of help our listeners get oriented. Rupert is the Earth name for Homer that we met in the pre-existence.
Homer.
And then Signe from Norway was Delsa. And so Rupert and Signe end up together in the Earth life, but not for very long, because Rupert dies after they have 4 kids. And then so Signe lives out the rest of her life without marrying again.
Yes.
Raising the 4 kids. But there's another couple, Heinrich and Marie, and she dies, and Heinrich remarries.
And with Heinrich, the interesting part in Norway is Heinrich and Signe. Heinrich was after Signe. He had lots of money, and he just wanted to help her and have her. And for whatever reason, I don't know. She took off, and
wasn't into him.
Yeah, wasn't into him, and she took off to the Americas. And so then Heinrich, it's what happens to him later, and he meets missionaries. He's converted. His whole family turns against him.
Right. All 4 of the people of those couples were converts.
Well, I think that Nephi includes those in the book because he very strongly believes in there's a destiny. You're destined to be with somebody. You're destined to marry somebody. That's kind of foreordained. And he plays that out in the afterlife mm-hmm. very much. But the reason he put that relationship between those two when they were in Norway is to show that, because he kept saying, well, he's nice, but she didn't feel right about him. And he talks much about that. And he specifically in several places makes it a distinct from romantic love, that there's this like eternal holy attraction,
something that you can't quite explain, but it's there when it's there, you know it.
Right. And that's this thread that still runs through Mormonism. And I brought up in the beginning, I was talking about this transition. And when you read 19th century views on celestial marriage and marriage in general, it's very kingdom oriented, dynastical, and they actually deride both the women and the men in the writings at the time deride romantic love. They say it's a weakness, and it's that. And I think here Nephi's playing that thought just out to its very end. He's on the very end of the tip of that idea in Mormonism, that, you know, we have these eternal relationships that are beyond this sort of infatuation. And because it's something they would say to the young people all the time, because, you know, they're marrying, you know, young women, especially off to older men. And they would try to dissuade that mm-hmm. that romanticism that, you know, in the Victorian and the Gilded Age Gilded Age was a little bit too late, but the Victorian era was still around. And you had to sort of squash that because they didn't want the young girls married the young men. They wanted to keep them for the old men.
Right. They're all this like the same age in the eternities. So, you know, what's 40 years, give or take?
On the earth, yeah.
More important than that, I mean, if you're a 22-year-old woman with 3 kids and you live in Panguitch and your husband's living up with his 3 other wives in Salt Lake, that's not a very romantic
situation.
Way to live. Yeah, situation in life. So you have to sort of quash those natural feelings.
Yeah, but I got the feeling that Nephi was a bit of a romantic.
Well, that's my point. So that's the 19th century Mormon view. And then the 20th century that you can see now is this hyper romanticized that we've talked about, especially some of the sex podcasts, where everything is sacred and everything is holy and there's this union.
Almost magic.
This magical relationship, and you have one man and one woman and they fulfill this joint destiny and they're equal in the Lord.
True soulmate.
And soul, yeah, all that hyper-romanticism taken to the nth degree. So what you have here where Nephi is writing the book is this transition between those two mm-hmm. separate views on marriage and sexuality and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I was really surprised to see those thoughts developed as early as 98. I thought those came like more in the 19 teens and stuff like that. You know, because there were still a lot of polygamists hanging around at the time. And
he was an author, you know, kind of an artist. Maybe yeah. he was a little ahead of his time.
When he would have been younger, you know, to him, the polygamist would have been like
the old guard.
The old generation. And we were debating before we recorded whether or not polygamy shows up. It may or may not in the book. It's not real clear.
Well, actually, you're right. Polygamy is not real clear in the book.
Because one of the characters does remarry, but it's after his wife has died. And it never says whether or not they're sealed or not.
Right.
So that's sort of a normal sort of, you know.
Yeah, event. They like each other, but it doesn't say whether they still have that marriage
right.
bond.
They meet again in the spirit world, but right. it doesn't make
it
clear.
But he pretty much just avoids the whole topic altogether. So I was surprised to see that sort of how quickly, I knew during that period we were transitioning out of the polygamy phase, but how quickly in this book, and probably that's one of the reasons this book was successful, because it gave a new narrative to latch onto and tied that in with those doctrinal elements. Now, the one I was referring to before, whose cousin is it?
Rachel is Heinrich's cousin.
Heinrich's cousin. That he meets up with. She's in Minnesota, and she goes to the temple and, you know, lives out this life, but she never marries.
Yes.
And though she was beautiful.
Even though she was, she was a blue-eyed,
it wasn't because she was ugly.
Yeah. Yeah, they made that point several times.
She was just so busy doing genealogy and temple work. Who has time for men? Come on.
She never found the right one.
Right, because she said she had solace with prayer. Like, she wanted to. He implied that she wanted to.
She would pray.
It was through no fault of her own.
Right, it made that absolutely clear. Yeah, yes. It wasn't her fault that she couldn't find a man to marry.
She had guys wooing her, but she couldn't give herself to them, and she didn't know why.
Right.
Until the spirit world.
Yes, of course.
In the spirit world, she marries somebody.
Who had died when he was on a mission, and his mother explains that he died because he had been tempted on his mission.
And I want to table that for just a minute.
Okay.
Let's come back
to
that.
That's such a good one.
Yeah.
Yes.
But the strange thing to me was they got their temple work done.
Uh-huh. Somebody did their temple work.
How in the world did somebody do their temple work?
They had never met in the earth life.
No, they'd never met.
Because at that time, they practiced sealing people who had never met.
Well, I don't think they did at that time. I think that was way earlier.
No, they still did.
Well, I wondered about that, but it seems like, I mean, I've heard some people talk about the sealing as not so much to a specific person, but into the celestial family. So they either by complete chance, those two were sealed on earth, or perhaps they were sealed to somebody else and they were just sealed up into the family. So since they liked each other in the spirit world, they're like, yippee.
Wait,
no,
just,
I think
go
it was
on about, hold on. I've never heard of this.
No,
before.
I haven't
the
either.
Spirit family?
They seal people to the spirit family?
Well, that might be just a more recent thing. I had a friend at one point whose parents, I believe, weren't sealed, but she and her husband and family were sealed, and it was a lot of distress that they hadn't been sealed to the parents. So when they spoke to higher leaders in the church, they were told that it's being sealed to the church family. They don't necessarily have to be sealed to their own parents, because they were afraid, I guess, that they'd be floating in the nebula if they weren't anchored in by something. So they were assured they were anchored into the celestial family.
Because the practice way I understand it right now is that, you know, let's say you're a woman who gets around and you've had 8 kids by 8 guys. They'll seal you to every single one of them. And then they will seal the offspring to the father, the biological father and the biological mother. So that's current.
Those that are dead?
For those people who are dead, yeah.
Okay, because I was going to say that doesn't seem like it would work.
No, but Zilpah's right. And, it was a practice during the early part of the church to, let's say that you had a kid who was 16.
By the way, John is pointing at Robin.
Yeah, Robin. I'm sorry. Robin, you have a kid that died when he was 16, and I had a daughter who died when she was 15. We might get together and seal our 2 children together. The 19th century, they did that. Or better yet, you have a daughter that's 15, and I'm married to Zilpha, and I come to you, a courtin', and I marry your 15-year-old dead daughter. That was common, too.
Ew.
Yeah, it's a little creepy. But he does imply in the book that the because he talks about what people do all the time when they're dead, which was kind of interesting.
They have houses.
They do have houses.
Many mansions.
Very strange to me.
But they would go and do genealogy work, and then somehow, that he doesn't describe, pass it down to like mortal beings. So I guess he implies there's this conduit somewhere where like interesting. Spirits are passing. Hey, you need to get these two married together.
One of the things I thought was kind of interesting about that sealing between Rachel and David was the fact that they were eagerly awaiting and they were allowed to get very close so they could almost watch it in the temple.
Yes.
Which, you know, you always hear those stories, you know, when you do baptisms for the dead and, oh, you know, wanting someone to make themselves present to you and to, you know,
yeah,
love you and adore you because you're doing their work.
David was the guy that Rachel was marrying, and he says to her, "And dear, the work is being done for us in the temple of our God. Yes, right now it is being done. Come, Rachel, let us go and be as near as we can. Yes, we have permission. This is the temple. God's messengers are here, and his spirit broods in and around the holy place. Do you see them clearly, Rachel? Yes, we shall not forget them when they too come to us in the spirit world, but we shall give them a welcome such as they have never dreamed of."
Definitely. They make a really big deal about the celebrations of the people
who did the work for the dead. They
are going to
be ahead socially in the afterlife.
Yeah. Socially, that's such a perfect way to put it, because they describe just the sad, forlorn people getting up there and like, oh, nobody's cheering for me. I didn't get any hugs. I didn't do my genealogy.
On that note, they also talked a lot about missionary work, especially missionary work beyond the veil. Mm-hmm. And which I think is probably doctrinally one of the best things of the book, to sort of explain Mormon doctrine in terms of this gradation of spirits, which is an important concept, that there are people who are sort of an infinite grade of development. And that sort of explains the mortal existence to some extent, explains what happens, that Mormons have done away with the traditional heaven and hell, because there are all these levels. And here's on page 143, Nephi says, "As there are graduations of righteousness and intelligence in the spirit world, there must be a vast field of usefulness for preaching the gospel, training the ignorant, helping the weak. As in the world of mortality, the work is carried on by those who have accepted the gospel and who have conformed their lives to its principles. So in the spirit world, the righteous find pleasant and profitable employment in working for the salvation of souls."
So that's which is what they still believe today. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. I was quite amazed at how the core doctrine of this book has not changed. The church itself has tried to distance itself from it. And he says some like nasty things in the book, marginally nasty about like the Methodists and stuff. When I read that, I sort of had a chuckle, because the church now, this book sort of outlines the way that the church is unique in its teachings. This gradation of souls, this migration through this eternal existence, you know, eventual on to celestial reward. And he doesn't even talk about deification in this book. It never comes up.
No.
But here's this uniquely sort of beautiful Mormon doctrine. But the church today has sort of put all that aside and just wanting to be another Christian sect, but with authority, you know. So why you have to be a Mormon is because you have to have baptism from the right person, not because, look, we have all these unique and beautiful doctrines.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think in those like many poems that were really hard to follow in the very end, there is something about, maybe it was as if gods, but there was some plurality of gods mentioned.
Well, his preface to go along with what John was just saying, the first thing he writes is, "A religion to be worthwhile must give satisfactory answers to the great questions of life. What am I? Whence came I? What is the object of this life? And what is my destiny?"
Yeah, I really like the book for this point, because it, in simple language, fleshes out the core of what it means to be Mormon, as I think those of us who grew up that way understand it, not the way we publicly face ourselves. And I don't know why the church feels the necessity to distance itself from this stuff. I guess the apologists would say they don't, blah, blah, blah. You just have to look in the right place. But you know, I feel like this stuff, you know, like he has that one point that they sing, Oh My Father, or whatever that song
is. Oh My Father.
And the person hears it, and that, you know, that speaks truth to him. But we almost sing that song with embarrassment today. We still sing it, but it's, and that's the one that says, you know, logic, and if I have a father, I have a mother, and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. So there was there was one that you that I tabled.
Oh yes.
Because I want to talk about why the Mormon God is a bastard again.
It was the son. So
David.
David, the one that Rachel ended up marrying in the spirit world, who she hadn't met until then. His mother had met Rachel in the temple and told her the story of David's death, which was David had gone on a mission and he was killed on his mission. And his mother was very distraught by this and saying, why couldn't you protect him, God? He was on his mission serving you. And she realized that it was because he was being tempted on his mission that God actually saved him from himself by killing him, by having him killed.
Which sort of undermines the whole plan, the whole plan, right? If God's going to knock people off right before they sin, doesn't that destroy the whole premise of the book?
It seems to, yes. I don't understand why that is even in here.
Well, because it seems like that's why they have the earth life, right? For the test. You got to be allowed to fail it.
But I don't get it.
But God's a jerk in this book. I mean, Rupert, that was his name, right?
Rupert.
Yeah. David is the missionary. Or are you talking about Rupert?
Rupert. He builds his farm up and then he loses it all because he's a successful farmer. The musician guy, he goes deaf.
He loves music. And God doesn't want him to.
Yeah, but we know why that happens, though.
Indulge himself with music.
Yes, because he loves music too much.
Right.
And so he has to be tried so he can then be the music director in the temple in the spirit world.
So God goes and evens, if you like something too much, you know, she'll die or your crops will fail or.
Yes.
This sort of idea that you can't be too happy. Otherwise, God's going to come in and smite you.
You can't invest yourself too much in one thing so that you're excellent at it. You're supposed to be more well-rounded. And he actually uses that phrase, you know, the rounded kind of personality is much more desirable.
Right. But I think that's kind of interesting because in the millennial phase, if that's okay to talk about at this point, they actually mentioned that's how they decide who they assign to jobs is who excels and does best. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be better to have someone that's really worked very hard at one thing?
Yeah.
I mean, I'd rather have Marie Curie, you know, curing cancer than, you know, someone who is really good at a whole lot of things and not so good at curing cancer. Yeah.
So, yeah, let's talk about the millennial phase because there was two books as I was reading this book that kept coming to mind over and over again, especially in this chapter. The first one was Thomas More's Utopia, and the second one was Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, which are both kind of crappy books in my mind, but
you're going to get some like bombs in the mail now.
Yes, no kidding.
All the Randian objectivists or whatever they're called. Because there's this. Let's take Ayn Rand's ideas first. This idea of these super uber people that everything happens. Because 90% of the world is lazy and stupid, but there's these really smart people who go make everything happen. And those are the people who deserve the highest reward. That theme permeates this whole book.
Yeah.
And Utopia comes in the explanation of the millennium. I swear there are phrases that he lifted straight off Sir Thomas More, but I'd have to go back and read it. When they're describing this utopian workers' paradise, but why it's not sort of communism. He doesn't ever use communism.
Well, wouldn't it be somewhat Marxist, at least when I've talked like this with my stepmother, who was a sociology professor back east, she referred me to Marx. I haven't finished the book yet, so I'm not an expert, but that's what she calls me when I talk about it.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are certainly those ideas. But what was most fascinating about when he describes what a worker's paradise is, right? Big factories, everybody's dressed in white, there's electricity.
It's clean.
He describes like today, you know, from him in the 19th century, when the world is covered in soot and ash, you know, for him, his paradise is like what we have today.
Yes. Yes. And that struck me a lot. And like you said, he mentions electricity, that all the buildings would have electricity and that they would be clean.
And wasn't there an ether line that was supposed to be more advanced than the electricity? And I thought it was.
Yeah, there were some things that I didn't quite understand. And
yes, because it's far more advanced. I know, the millennium.
Yeah, in the millennium, the setup is that the king of Poland comes over to the Lord's city, I guess it is. And they still were riding horses because they prefer that way as opposed to moving by electric carriage or whatever.
They could enjoy the journey.
And I guess they took the king of Poland there so that, so I mean, Nephi did it that way so that we could be like the visitors to this millennial city.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a common literary device. You have to have an unknown character walking through to represent us.
But right.
Yeah, they show this workers' utopian paradise where they only, you know. But
they have resurrected beings there.
Yeah, Socrates.
Yeah, and George Washington.
Definitely.
Who are teaching the kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, what better history teachers?
yeah, and like there's one point where they go into a chair factory, and they explain that they have machines that can immediately pop out good chairs, but some people carve them just because that's what they like to do.
Definitely.
So, and that's where he's trying to work out that paradisical, you know, what exactly do people do with all their time?
Well, yeah, and it's interesting because they still have a monetary system, which seemed kind of interesting, that it was this interesting balance between having a monetary system and kind of, you know, kind of a more consecrated life. For one thing, you know, you'd think everyone's equal. He was trying to explain why some people had so much better than some others, or at least differently than others. And so whose mansion was it? Anyway, there was a mansion where they described there was beautiful paintings.
The artist.
No, yes. It was the author.
Oh, yeah, the author. That's true.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, they go to an author, the most wonderful author in the millennium, and he has this beautiful home
with statues
and paintings and apparently antiques.
Yeah, expensive stuff.
Yeah, but they explained it isn't because he is any more righteous. It's because it is these beautiful things that inspire him to his best creation.
Right, so he deserves them.
Yes, exactly.
Well, yeah, you know, you got to look after your own, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. The writer was the pinnacle position in the millennium.
I found that part that talks about the belching, the chimneys belching forth their blackness and poison into the atmosphere. Our city is clean and the air above us is as clear as that above forests or fields. And then he talks about this was pretty futuristic, I think. We use electricity for heat also. We get it direct from the earth. They have it generated by water power from falls and the waves of the sea. And they also learned how to collect energy from the sun, heat from the sun.
Yeah, and you do have to remember that at the time this book was written, that's when everybody burned coal. And it was awful. It was a miserable thing.
So that was a big problem they were trying to solve at that time.
Right. So, you know, so electricity was around. Cars, you know, gas-powered cars were around, but they really hadn't taken off. So you know, somebody read the newspapers would be aware of them. So I thought as far as a futurist goes, he did okay.
I thought so.
Yeah, he did. And did you hear the number of temples that he saw as being a millennial number?
Yeah, was
100.
100, yeah.
Holy cow, he would have been so pleased. When did we pass that up?
It was the millennium.
Yeah.
And we just didn't know it.
Exactly.
Yeah, so, all in all, I think the book gave a good representation of the ideas of, you know, the Mormon millennium and the Mormon rejection of hell. And he went into that, you know, the people sort of suffered because they were aware of their own, you know, state of sin as opposed to this lake of brimstone or whatever, and sort of fleshing it out. I thought it was a decent job.
Yeah, overall, I actually kind of enjoyed it, and partly because of the perspective it gave. And, you know, I've never read a fictional Mormon book this old, and it was just really interesting to see his perspective and what he thought would the especially the millennium. That was just fascinating.
Well, and, you know, one thing we didn't address in there, you know, we talked about his ideals, you know, in the white factory, but very much I got the strong sense of that rural Utah and what they were working for, you know, that hard work and building up a homestead and being self-sufficient and growing your own alfalfa and all that stuff sort of plays out over and over in the book. It's very clear, you know, that he's writing from a rural Utah perspective of the time, and to see some of those or those thoughts percolating, which are still permeate the culture, especially along this, the corridor, was really fascinating.
Definitely. And when those things fail, it is for your own good. It is for your benefit.
Yeah. Yeah. And things that would have been, you know, when was the failure? Wasn't it 1898, the big bank failure of that time? I can't remember all the depressions and recessions, but, you know, so things like railroad speculation and failure of the banks would have been very current to, you know, to him at the time. Not a real controversial book. I did call God a name again.
Oh, let's come up with a little bit of controversy.
You just said he was mean, right?
Or a jerk.
Yeah.
A jerk, yeah.
Something like that. Let's get some controversy.
What's controversial?
You were talking about the blacks, which that had escaped me. So the one controversy that I, you know, my pet peeve irritation of the book, besides promoting mediocrity, was the sexism, because definitely it was sexist, but it became the most obvious in my book, which is a very recent edition, is page 103, where they're talking about Signa, and I believe she may be with Rachel, I'm not sure, but it's definitely Signa, who is preaching to the other women in spirit prison. And they're trying to explain the gospel to the women in spirit prison in the spirit world. And she says, "We shall be pleased to talk with you. We are not very wise, but we may always ask the brethren who are wiser for more light."
Right.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean,
shiver.
He is sort of a product of his time, I suppose. He does give the one character where she independently goes to the temple and does the work and stays independent. So Rachel? Yeah, Rachel.
Yeah, but she does temple work pretty much her whole life, but
she does. And there was the one line, I wish I could go back and find it, where she goes to say, "It's as if my life's been on," and it was like, then they finish it, like she's been waiting or her life's been on hold, because that she said that her earth life was as if she was waiting. She was on hold her entire earth life because she didn't have a man.
Yeah, that was pretty clear.
I don't think it says she didn't have a man. She needed that
she
connection,
was waiting.
That marriage.
Yeah.
she was waiting.
Right, I'm sure it didn't say directly because she didn't have a man.
But that was an implication through one of the things
blacks.
About the book was oftentimes areas of their lives were hyper condensed. So he was trying to give this view, and he even states it sometimes where there's this long view that for us life is this very short, just this one incident. So things that seem unjust in the world, or where you can spend your life waiting, or you can lose something seemingly unjustly, it all works out in the end because
it's just a blink.
So I didn't read that, although I think it would be a valid idea of the time that, you know, a woman is validated by a man. Hell, it's still around today. But I think the bigger point he was trying to make is that sort of we have to fit into this God's puzzle and we have to play our role.
Yes. And clearly the women's role is to encourage the men, you know, to reach their full potential.
But I think it could have been a lot more sexist than it was for
yeah,
the time it was
written.
Yeah,
it could have been more. It could have been more.
So,
definitely, that's true.
It wasn't too bad that way.
All right.
Too bad.
Well, Zilpha and Robin.
Yep.
Thanks for walking us through another book. I think generally I recommend it.
Yeah, I think it's worth a read.
Yeah, definitely.
Not too hard to read.
And
either.
Especially if you're new to Mormonism and trying to understand sort of those concepts, because I think a lot of the things to me were familiar, you know, doctrines and folk doctrines and speculation that you hear in church growing up are really expressed strongly in the book.
Yeah, and just as a side note, pre-correlation, one reason why I was so interested in this book was because reading through my mom's journal after she died, she mentioned in the journal, it mentions that she was called on a stake mission. She would have been in her mid-20s. She married when she was 27, which was really an old maid back in the day. Early 50s, I think is what I said. Or mid-50s, and her stake mission was she presented Added Upon.
Really?
She would travel from ward to ward and give a presentation about Added Upon. And so as I read this book, it had so much...
Because you were thinking of your mom.
Yeah, so much personal meaning, because all of a sudden, my mother's became very clear to me, the things she said and the things she did. And she, in fact, put a page in front of each of our journals that gave our pre-existent story and what went on with us there. And so anyway, I thought this was really fun. And thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks, Robin.
Hey, you're welcome. All right. As always, the discussion continues on the website at mormonexpression.com. I go there to check out things like the cruise and to get your tickets to the live show August 6th. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.